Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by George Weigel. George is a distinguished senior fellow of Washington's Ethics and Public Policy Center, which is one of the world's leading authorities on the Catholic Church. The Vatican analyst for NBC News, George is the author of 15 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Witness to Hope, the biography of Pope John Paul II. His work has been translated into more than a dozen languages. We're going inside the pages of George Weigel's book, The End and the Beginning, Pope John Paul II, The Victory of Freedom, The Last Years, The Legacy, published by Doubleday Religion. Welcome, George.
Good morning.
The End and the Beginning, Pope John Paul II, The Victory of Freedom, The Last Years, The Legacy. What a phenomenal work. I couldn't put it down. I'm blurry-eyed from staying up way too late reading the whole thing.
Well, I hope you enjoyed it as well as getting blurry-eyed.
Totally worth it, every portion of it, because it is a tremendous completion to Witness to Hope. With part one of the book, you enter into that whole era of the communist attack upon John Paul that you didn't have evidence prior to that when you originally wrote Witness to Hope.
Well, I think we all suspected that the communist authorities of Central and Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union perceived John Paul II as a mortal threat. What I am now able to document in this new book through the use of materials that have only become available from archives in Berlin and Warsaw and Moscow over the past 10 years is the magnitude of this assault on Karol Wojtyla, which really dates back to the mid-1950s, 20-some years before he was elected to the papacy, continues throughout his time as Archbishop of Krakow, and then, of course, ramps up with great vigor after he is elected pope. This is an amazing story. Several people who have read the book have told me that the first third of it reads like a spy novel, to which I have to say, yeah, and the difference is this is true. This all actually happened, and to be able to look at this through the prism of, if you will, the bad guy's own archives is really quite striking, I think.
Well, it is. The people that are involved in this story, besides Karol Wojtyla, our beloved Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, you tell us the compelling story of Cardinal Wyszynski. His role in this, he is, in a very real way, a spiritual father to John Paul.
Stefan Wyszynski, who was the primate of Poland from 1947 until his death in 1981, was surely one of the most consequential and important churchmen of the second half of the 20th century. He was a man of extraordinary courage, great, great shrewdness in terms of his political understanding, and he defined a line of confrontation with the communist regime in Poland that I think really, in retrospect, provides a model for this kind of business when the church is under these sorts of pressures in an intensely Catholic country. And the attempt by the communist secret police in Poland and elsewhere to wreck Wyszynski's reputation, to put wedges between him and the Vatican, is a dramatic story that I don't think has ever been told in English before, and is now told in The End and the Beginning, thanks to these archival materials from communist secret police files that I have acquired over the past 10 years.
Anything surprise you?
Well, I'm not surprised that this happened, although a lot of people seem to have forgotten what the Cold War was about. I hope I never have. It was actually something I was engaged in a lot of human rights work in the 1970s and 1980s. So I was not surprised that communist intelligence agencies were trying to penetrate the church and were trying to do in various ways, senior churchmen. I think the surprises are the sheer magnitude of the effort. I mean, we're talking here about millions of man hours of labor and billions of dollars of resources spent on the communist attack on the Catholic Church. I suppose the second thing that I found striking, and while I suspected it, I think it's now more firmly documented, is the degree to which the Vatican itself was penetrated by these Soviet bloc intelligence operatives, and the rather insouciant attitude in the Vatican of Pope Paul VI toward that. The Vatican really had no counterintelligence capability, didn't seem very concerned about all of this. And as I document in the book, that led to the Church, meaning the Holy See, being put at a real disadvantage in some negotiations with governments in Hungary, Poland, then Czechoslovakia, and elsewhere.
Do you think that they've learned, the Vatican has learned from this error in judgment as far as being prepared for this type of filtration? I mean, has it gotten any better?
Well, I think the general security situation at the Vatican has tightened up since 9/11. As far as this business of dealing with communist intelligence services, John Paul II took some quiet measures, which I describe in the end and the beginning, to make sure that paper that he didn't want floating around and getting into the wrong hands didn't float around and get into the wrong hands. And I describe the procedures he put in place in some detail in the book.
It's still surprising that his role in this collapse of communism is still underplayed by secular media today, isn't it?
Actually, I think it's getting better. If I may say, I wrote the first book making this argument in 1992. It was called The Final Revolution. And it was regarded as a kind of strange idea at the time, this notion that the Church and the Pope had something to do with the collapse of communism. 2 years ago, Yale University's John Lewis Gaddis, who I think is widely recognized as the country's premier historian of the Cold War, published a new history of the Cold War in which he simply states flatly, the beginning of the end of European communism came when John Paul II got off the plane in Warsaw on June 2, 1979. I think it's very satisfying to see people of Professor Gaddis's stature recognize this. And I think this is widely, certainly far more widely recognized today than it was 18 years ago. What I think people are forgetting now is the intensity of the confrontation between the end of the Second World War and the collapse of European communism in 1989. But we should have been reminded of this and what the stakes, in fact, were by the beatification as a martyr earlier this year of Father Jerzy Popiełuszko, the martyr priest of Solidarity, who was, of course, killed in the mid-1980s by the same Polish secret police officer who a year and a half earlier had been involved in an attempt to blackmail John Paul II.
The thing that is so poignant and compelling about that first part of the book is the reminder of the brutality, the torture, how cruel the era was. Maybe we've lost a sense in it sometimes when we go back and we intellectualize that history, but you've really brought back that remembrance of the pain of that time.
Well, I think it's important to remember. It's important to remember in order to honor the suffering of those who bore the weight of that persecution. It's important to remember for the sake of history. And it's important to remember because were we ever to see the signs of similar persecution emerging in various places around the world, it's important to know where those signs can lead and put effective countermeasures into place.
The word suffering, that is something that really was a hallmark. There's so much that's been put on everything that he has taught us through his work in philosophy and theology, his instruction, but his living out that life of suffering, especially in those later years, you really bring out again in a very poignant way.
Well, I have come to think of the last weeks and months of John Paul II's life as his last encyclical, his last great teaching moment in a 26 and a half year pontificate, during which he led the Church and the world into an experience of the Paschal mystery of the death and resurrection of Christ, thus offering the Church and the world his last priestly service. because that, after all, is what Catholic priests are ordained to do. They're ordained to bring people into the Paschal mystery of the crucified and risen Lord, and that's what John Paul II did in a very, very powerful way throughout his illness, but most powerfully from February 1st through April 2nd, 2005, during the 2 months of his last illness.
After the publication of Witness to Hope and those subsequent years following and leading into the Great Jubilee, you must have just been chomping at the bit to be able to chronicle the rest of the story.
Well, I had always intended, if God was kind and I was given the time to do this, to finish what I started. And I'm glad I waited 5 years after the Pope's death. That gives one a little bit of distance. And it also allowed me to get hold of these archival materials from behind the former Iron Curtain, which are so essential to the drama of the first third of the book. As for the second third of the book, the chronicling of the last 6 years of the pontificate, I think it's only perhaps now, as the high emotion of the time recedes, that we can see just how important the last quarter of John Paul II's papacy was. I mean, it included the Great Jubilee of 2000, which in his mind was the key to a quarter century of his work. That included such dramatic moments as his visit to the Holy Land. That included 9/11 and all that came after that. That included the revelations of sexual abuse and episcopal misgovernance in the church. It included his Silver Jubilee in 2003, and then into the drama of the last year. So it was a very, very full period of time. And I think it was probably a good idea to wait some time to put all that down, although obviously I was collecting materials and taking notes throughout all of that.
The thing that you also bring forward, that beautiful thread throughout the entire book, is his spirituality, and especially the importance of the Carmelite spirituality that he so anchored his interiority with.
Well, he was a man deeply formed by the spiritual writing and example of St. John of the Cross, going back to his late teenage years during the Second World War. And I don't doubt that he experienced dark nights of the soul throughout his own life. I suggest that one of those took place in the summer and fall of 2003, right as he was going into the Silver Jubilee of his pontificate. But as you say, that was part of the rhythm of his spiritual life for the better part of six decades. So there's no reason to think it wouldn't have been part of it at the end.
Again, recalling that he actually lived during a time of tremendous suffering, that darkness that covered his land as well as the world in so many respects, is something we do need to recall today in an era where we cry out in fear of what may be coming, whether caused by governments or by our own sinfulness. But that era, the 20th century, was one of the bleakest times in human history, wasn't it?
Well, I think one of the things that is being quickly forgotten about the 20th century is that it was the greatest century of persecution in the history of the church. This was something that John Paul II was eager to lift up and remind the world of during the Great Jubilee of 2000. More Christians were killed for the faith in the 20th century than in the previous 19 centuries put together. That's a simply astonishing fact, but it is a fact. And that's an important fact to remember, particularly if one believes, as the church has believed for two millennia, that the blood of martyrs is the seed of the church's future. And out of that awfulness in the 20th century, and out of the great witness of Christians in facing that awfulness, I think John Paul II believed we could experience a new springtime of the gospel, as he put it on many occasions throughout the last 10 years of his pontificate.
Evangelization, he will be recalled invoking the new era of evangelization throughout the world. That is a tremendous legacy that he has amongst many others.
Well, he was a pope who believed that the church does not exist for its own sake, for the maintenance of its own institutional structure. Rather, all of that exists so that the church can proclaim the gospel. The church is about evangelization. The church doesn't have a mission. The church is a mission. Mm. And his determination to remind the church really began on October 22, 1978, at his first great public mass as Pope in St. Peter's Square, with that signature phrase, "Be not afraid, open the doors to Christ." And that continued for 26 and a half years. Some parts of the church have gotten that message and are living it actively and in a compelling way. Other parts don't seem to have gotten with the program yet.
What is it about some who will label him as an oppressor, someone who tried to keep not only women down, but just the ability for man to be able to reason freely on his own, and so many other labels that get slapped onto him? When you reflect on his life, how can they negate the fact that he did so much to try to raise up our appreciation of the dignity of each human person and their ability to be able to express themselves?
Well, at a certain point, I think you have to say this is just willful stupidity on the part of the critics. They haven't read the materials. They haven't studied the Pope's teaching. So you have to say, look, you've just made up your mind before you've conjured with and wrestled with the facts of the case. This is obviously influenced by certain media storylines which get set into concrete and are very difficult to move. But I think for the people who get it about the new evangelization, all of this is just froth on the top of the kettle, and it's stuff that really doesn't need to be paid too much attention to. Obviously, there's another group of people who push that line of the reactionary John Paul II, and that is people within the church who are using that to try to advance their own agendas. But they have simply not figured out that the revolution that they anticipated hasn't happened and isn't going to happen because it's completely counter to the reality of the church and its life. The church does not make up its tradition. The church lives out of its tradition. And that's a living tradition. It's not a static thing. But it is real and it is there. And the world did not begin anew between 1962 and 1965 at the Second Vatican Council. The Council, as John Paul II consistently reminded the Church for 26 and a half years, was meant to prepare the Church for a springtime of evangelization in the third millennium. And for people to, frankly, waste time endlessly arguing implausible interpretations of the Council in order to advance implausible understandings of Catholicism is a tragedy. Mm. But there's a certain generation of people who are going to keep gnawing on those particular bones forever. And happily, that doesn't seem to be making much of an influence on a younger generation, which isn't interested in the battles of the 60s and wants to get on with embracing the friendship of Jesus Christ, as Pope Benedict says, and then get on with changing the world by evangelizing the world.
A legacy, of course, is something that would transcend just the real close years following a death, but would last into generations. And his legacy, as far as that dialogue with not only religions, but peoples within political systems, is that something that we're going to be able to maintain? I mean, whether it's with those of the Islamic persuasion in their religious beliefs or other forces that might try to attack that foundational truth.
I think the legacy of John Paul II within the church is secure. He left behind an extraordinarily rich, complex, lengthy body of teaching, which the church has not even begun to digest completely, and with which the church will be wrestling for several hundred years, I expect. What the Pope's attempts to open a line of dialogue with Islam, which have been continued by Benedict XVI, will come to, I don't know. I'm a bit more skeptical on that front. but at least with John Paul II and Benedict XVI, the line of serious dialogue, which has to be at this moment in history, when we're discussing the future with Islamic interlocutors about religious freedom, about reciprocity and recognizing each other's legitimate rights to freedom of religion, and about the separation of religious and political authority in a justly governed state. And those are the issues. They've been defined by these last two pontificates, and at least we know what we got to be talking about now.
We would like to say that there has been the demise of communism throughout the world. Has there been, George, or is it taking on a new and different look?
Well, communism as a world historical project of the sort imagined by Lenin and his heirs, that's over with. I mean, you've got little outposts of this in various backwaters like North Korea and Cuba, or even this ridiculous business in Venezuela today. But China is a different model. It's a kind of authoritarian capitalism. Vietnam seems to be struggling towards a different kind of model. Cuba, even Fidel Castro has admitted that that isn't working anymore. So I think, yeah, as a world historical project, that's over with. The notion behind the communist project, namely that you can manipulate history in order to produce a kind of worldly utopia through politics, and even hardball politics if necessary, mm-hmm. that, alas, is still very much part of the 21st century world political and cultural scene. And obviously we see elements of it all over the place. And this, of course, has to be resisted in the name of a proper Christian understanding of the dignity of the human person, of the fact that human beings are never to be used as means to others' ends, and of the proper limits of the state in its role vis-a-vis society. So there are a lot of arguments left to engage, but I don't think it makes much sense to call them communist.
You described him in the book as the prophet of a new and genuine humanism. Is that, again, a part of that great legacy that hopefully will be broken open even more as the years have come? Because I don't think we fully have appreciated that yet.
Oh, I hope so. I mean, and I think so. His understanding of the dignity of the human person, of the possibilities of the human person, is so much more rich and compelling than that offered by these frankly idiotic new atheists like Richard Dawkins, who's been ranting away in England over the past several weeks, that I think it has to have a real chance of success. It's just a much more compelling vision. Dawkins would have us believe that we are simply congealed stardust, a total accident of evolutionary biology. That's not a very compelling vision of human life. John Paul II would have us believe that we are here because of the purposes of a loving creator who enters history and invites us to follow him along the path he, the creator, is taking through history in the person of his son, the second person of the Trinity incarnate in Jesus of Nazareth. That's real drama. Dawkins's congealed stardust is not drama. So I think we got a much better, to use the overused word of the decade, we have a much better narrative to sell here. A much more compelling vision of human possibility than our enemies. And I think that's why they are going so nutso these days. When you look at the virulence of this attack, not only on Benedict XVI, but on historic Christianity prior to the Pope's visit to the UK, these people are coming unhinged. Now, why are they coming unhinged? I think they're coming unhinged because they may suspect that they're losing, that the package they've been selling is not being bought. And that's very scary for people like that, whose entire lives are invested in this ideology of diminishment of understanding of the human person.
What are your thoughts on his successor as far as his ability to be able to follow in his footsteps?
Benedict XVI is obviously a very different personality than John Paul II, but as he has demonstrated here in the U.S., as he demonstrated recently in Britain, he has a compelling personality in his own right. He had tremendous crowds in Britain. People were very responsive. He's a man of extraordinary intellect. I think what people are learning is that he's a real pastor, too.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a pastor's heart, and he can communicate that very effectively. I wish the communications apparatus that ought to be telling this story to the world from the Vatican were much better than it is, because I think their incapacities have created no small part of the problems that we've been experiencing in this pontificate for more than 5 years now. But the man himself is a very compelling new evangelist in his own right, and for that we should be very grateful.
Well, George, the end and the beginning, Pope John Paul II, the victory of freedom, the last years, the legacy is just a tremendous work. To anyone who loves the late, great Holy Father or those who need to get to know him and to appreciate those years in the church, this is a phenomenal offering that you've given us along with Witness to Hope. What are you working on next?
Well, I'm running around the country for 2 months talking about this book, and I think we'll leave it at that for the moment. It's been a great honor to spend 15 years working on the life of John Paul II, and I'm now going to spend some months going around and talking about him again, perhaps for the last time in this concentrated and extensive way. But I do hope people enjoy the end and the beginning. I enjoyed writing it. I'm told it's a good read, and I hope it continues our reflection on one of the great men of our time and indeed one of the great saints of our time.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, and we wish you safe travels as you go off and you evangelize the evangelizer.
Thank you.
We've been going inside the pages of The End and the Beginning, Pope John Paul II, The Victory of Freedom, The Last Years, The Legacy, with George Weigel. To pick up a copy of George's book, go to www.eppc.org, the website for the Ethic and Public Policy Center located in Washington, D.C., or pick it up at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, go to www.insidethepages.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.